Creative Babble.
Hey guys, here's one more bonus episode before season 4 starts. It's from the Twisted Podcast with John Taylor. I asked John if I could stitch together 2 of his episodes and play them on my feed. Lucky for you, he said yes. But before we start the episode, I met up with John at a coffee shop to talk about his story. And we have a celebrity who listens to the show. Her name is Allison Sweeney from Days of Our Lives and The Biggest Loser. And she has a new project, and she's going to tell us all about it at the end of the show. So stick around. So you've actually worked in law enforcement for many years.
Yeah. So, I mean, I write true crime as well as the podcast. And previously I was an agent with the Secret Service many years ago. I'm currently a private investigator licensed here in North Carolina. So I do still actively investigate criminal cases.
And your show is freaking awesome. And so I wanted the world. Well, the world. Because the whole world.
The pretend radio world.
The pretend radio world to listen to. Now, I really wanted my audience to check it out because we've been wanting to collaborate for a long time. And I listened to 2 of your episodes that really blew me away. And I wanted to share it with my audience. Can you tell me about the episodes we were going to play?
Yeah, I think you picked 2 very interesting episodes in my perspective. This is an interview I did with an author named John Fay, who he had a relationship with the serial killer Arthur Shawcross, who was considered the Genesee Killer. And so they corresponded back and forth in letters while Shawcross was in prison. And that's interesting enough, but John Fay is a very peculiar individual in that he's highly intelligent, but he's also very disturbed. He is kind of considers himself like somebody who never became a serial killer, but who has thought about it, who thinks about killing people, who thinks about cannibalism.
Is John Fay just a regular guy in real life? Like, would most people know that he has this obsession with the macabre?
It's hard to tell because he's brutally honest in some ways. So I have a lot of respect for him that he does not hold back. He tells, you know, what's on his mind. But a lot of what is on John Fay's mind is very uncomfortable and disturbing to a lot of people. And to me, what is so fascinating about John Fay and Arthur Shawcross within this episode is that where is that line between thinking about something and doing something really horrific? And with Arthur Shawcross and John Fay, there's the line. It's sitting there between the two of them. And it's hard to tell where it is and what kept John from going over it and what allowed Arthur to do it.
But you actually had a conversation with John Fay. What was that like?
It was much more comfortable and engaging than almost any conversation I've ever had. He was somebody I felt like I could just continue to talk to. I felt like he was pretty, I don't know, self, not confident necessarily, but just he knows who he is. And he's very much willing to talk about anything. And he's not going to give you a superficial answer. There's a lot of depth to everything he says. So I found it very fascinating. It's unnerving, the things that he is interested in and fixated on, but I would probably not necessarily want to spend a lot of time with him. But as far as a conversation goes, I was looking forward to that conversation as much as I've looked forward to any conversation.
And do you think that the guy next to us has any idea what we're talking about?
What is
the guy next to us? Does he have any idea what we're talking about?
He's probably completely freaked out right now.
Because this is what we do. We just go to coffee shops and talk about really bizarre stuff, right? This is our thing.
It's the way we roll, yeah.
Okay, so without further ado, this is the Shawcross Letters from the Twisted Podcast with John Taylor.
Talk to me a little bit about how you began communicating with Arthur Shawcross.
Uh,
Well, he wrote to me, actually, initially, because I was selling some of his artwork, his drawings on eBay, back when you could still do that. It was known as Murderabilia. You could still sell the stuff, but on different websites. But, you know, he discovered that I was doing that and basically wrote to me asking where I had got the drawings, which was from, I guess, groupies of his that I was having interesting trades with on eBay, because I used to be a regular seller on there. And we thought about splitting the profits, as he would do more drawings, and I would send him a money order for like 50% of whatever I sold him for, and he was very amenable to that. And we struck up a communication from there, and then eventually grew into a friendship, I suppose, a very close friendship at that. Basically the summary of how we initially met.
Well, in the book, you mentioned kind of having a level of comfort in communicating with Arthur. Why do you think you felt so at ease with him?
He was one of the very few people who accepted me at that time, because I guess you could say we had similar mindsets in a sense, where I especially back then, I suffered what I call the affliction, or just it. You know, it was more Jeffrey Dahmer type thinking, I suppose, like people and collecting people. And there's not many other human beings you could talk to about these things. And you mention it to a therapist, where you have to be careful because they will have you locked up. It was a very unique opportunity to kind of get this off my chest and discuss the affliction with somebody who wouldn't judge me or have me put away. And just a macabre serendipity, I guess you could say.
Did you have an objective, or, and if so, what was your objective in communicating with him?
Friendship, really. I finally had someone to talk to. For me, I had no other ulterior motives or anything along those lines. It was really, for me, it was just a human connection, I suppose, that I was lacking during that period, especially. I'm still lacking today, really, but I'm dealing with it in much more diplomatic, healthy ways.
Do you think that your communications with Arthur Shawcross allowed you to kind of feel understood, or is it kind of like you were comparing yourself to him, so you felt maybe less different?
Yeah, I guess you could say that. I wasn't feeling as cut off from the world or as alienated. It was just, it was an acceptance and somebody I could, again, discuss my more demonic thoughts with openly. And it was just therapeutic writing. Just the writing itself was therapeutic. And to get that out of my system, like I say, purging my boogeyman, as it were.
By writing to him?
Yes. And then ultimately writing the book, of course.
But I was going to say, so in the book, you show a lot of Arthur Shawcross's letters to you, but you don't show the letters you wrote to him. So I guess my kind of twofold would be, what were you writing to him, and how personal did you get with him?
Yeah, it was just, I got very personal. I talk a little bit about that, or I expound upon it in the book. The letters of mine aren't showing, I don't have them, but basically the gist of it was talking about a very intense interest in collecting mummified human heads, at least the replicas of them. Very realistic replicas, and the shrunken heads again, and things like that I would discuss with him, and we would get into some very dark topics, like just Jeffrey Dahmer, talk about Jeffrey Dahmer, of course, and cannibalism. Cannibalism was sometimes central to our communication. So, I mean, things like that, just, it was a give and take, just back and forth. Again, it was very cathartic for me to be able to discuss this type of thing with him. But it got into some very dark subjects, basically.
His letters seemed to kind of bounce around. And like, there would be a paragraph about, the weather and how much it's snowing there. And then the next paragraph would go into something, something very dark as far as something he had done to a victim or whatever.
Right. Yeah. Chopping their heads off or whatever, absolutely. It seemed almost a schizophrenic type of communication in a way. I mean, it's so deep down the rabbit hole, it's not going to be logical to a lot of people. But, yeah, I mean, we would have normal discussions, in a sense, like you say, the weather or just regular his daily activities in prison, my own writing and whatnot. I was always working on some writing project, you know, so yeah, we both bounce around like that.
Were you afraid to get personal with him?
No, I was never concerned about that. Developed a very comfortable rapport with the man. So it felt like a family member, I suppose you could say, because I never felt very close to any of my bloodline, really. And anyone I did get close to my bloodline died. So I just, yeah, he was basically all I had for a long, long time. And of course, he died too in the end. So that's my life.
Did he ever give you advice or suggestions or anything regarding kind of your affliction as far as how to cope with it or anything that he had done? Had you ever talked about that with him?
I don't think he was overt in encouraging me to do it, to do any of these deeds, like as far as murder and cannibalism, shrinking people's heads. But, you know, basically he would say, if you're going to do it, he'd always say, be good at it. So, yeah, it was like that. And so in a way, in a kind of some subterfuge, he was encouraging me.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting interpretation of coping with it. I guess I was kind of thinking on the other side rather than acting on it as a way of coping with it. You know, because he was in prison, he couldn't, you know, act on his affliction once he was in prison. So, you know, he had to control it on some level. So he never talked to you about how he was able to control it or anything like that?
You know, I know towards the end of his life, he was starting to get into religion, and but we never talked about that aspect. As far as him controlling it in prison, I mean, it just, again, no avenues to act on it. With myself, it's interesting. He sent me a photograph or a couple of photographs one time of this woman he felt had turned her back on him. And it was almost like he was hinting at my going out to assassinate her, I suppose, which I would not do. But again, he wasn't obvious about that, but he did send me her photographs and said some very nasty things about this person.
Seemed like some things he was very overt about, but others he was quite subtle.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's true. But things like that, it was that was the darker side of our friendship, our relationship, something like that. And I think actually she was in Virginia too. Yeah, I don't know if that expounds on anything, but
in general, like kind of Arthur Shawcross's talk of murder and cannibalism, were those things that was it interesting to you just because most people don't talk about them, or did you find it kind of off-putting?
No, I mean, it was my life. It was more than interesting. It was a personal passion at the time, you know, and I wasn't sure which road I was going to take if I too was going to act on these things. And that's the story, my life here, that I came out on the other side of that more or less. I mean, it's not a complete 180 turn just yet, but, you know, I'm getting there. But, yeah, no, it was fascinating to me. I could identify with it because it was something I was going through as far as those types of thoughts, those thought patterns, which come straight from hell, as they say. It's not a human way to think, and I recognize that, especially nowadays. Yeah, it was just something I had a very a personal interest in and at a very intimate level, I suppose you could say.
Yeah, and you, at one point in the book, you described Shawcross as pure breed evil. And I guess my question would be, do you separate his acts from your relationship with him, or do they kind of blend in together for you?
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I don't necessarily agree with what he did, especially some of his earlier acts there. You know, it kind of blended into, you know, our relationship and communication. But again, I don't want anyone to think that I necessarily agree with what he did. I was just trying to, part of it was trying to figure out who and what I was and am, you know. So it's just trying to decipher my own psychology. And, you know, I had a very, again, unique opportunity to do this with Arthur Shawcross, you know. So we weren't, like I say, exactly eye to eye. But, I mean, it was really the best I could do. And it's, you know, kind of a hellish blessing.
You know, along with kind of your affliction, you talked about you alluded to them already, but you have, you know, some pretty intriguing interests, I guess I would call them, such as cannibalism or the shrunken heads. What is it specifically about those things that so fascinate or interest you?
Well, particularly it's about motivation for me would be to collect people and preserve them. Basically, it'd be more about, for me, companionship. Again, it's like a Dahmer of mindset where, you know, it's like you have a safe friend, you know, somebody who can't stab you in the back. And I've literally just about been stabbed in the back by a best friend of 20 years. So, I mean, it's just, basically for me, it is about the companionship and preservation of human beauty. And as far as the cannibalism, it's more of assimilation or absorbing their spirit into your own, kind of, like I say, a quick and dirty way to upload their soul into your own soul and, modify oneself. So, but yeah, again, that's all part of our collection. And
yeah, I've heard many serial killers kind of describe either the act of killing someone and also, I guess, the cannibalism as the ultimate control over another individual. Do you see it that way for you, or is it more just kind of what you were describing before?
It's both. I mean, it's definitely an ultimate control over another human, but it's not even like I necessarily get off on that. I just, I guess I have some very, very serious separation anxiety now throughout my life. That's part of it. So, again, it's just about maintaining a very safe friendship with someone you're attached to, or even an enemy, someone you perceive as your enemy, to collect them. That is ultimate control right there, and or eat part of them.
In reading the book, which was an excellent book, by the way, I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
The question that I had throughout this book, because this book to me is more about you than it is about Arthur Shawcross, though it's certainly
right.
About Shawcross as well.
Yeah.
And the question that just kept going over in my head, and whether you have an answer to it or not, and that is, why didn't your kind of your deviant fantasies, I guess I'll describe them as, how come you never crossed the line into action?
Yeah, that's a billion-dollar question. I've come very close, as you read a little bit of that in the book. But the thing is, I still have a sliver of empathy in me, aside from that, it's the prospect of spending 1,000 years in prison. You know, that's the biggest deterrent for me personally. But you go beyond that into the spiritual, and then, karma catches up with you eventually. But again, I do still have some empathy in me, where I want to treat others as I want to be treated. And again, more so nowadays, I'm less sociopathic these days. But, I'm not 100%, cured yet.
What do you think it is that drives your darker feelings and thoughts?
Probably feelings of general betrayal by humanity. And, it's just not being in control of really much in this world. It's almost like a panic. You know, it's really almost like a panic. Again, it's the whole abandonment thing. You know, because, everyone close to me has passed away. I've passed away, and I keep losing people and friends turn on you, so-called friends. And so it's really just, I think the major portion of it is a lack of control over, humanity in general.
Kind of starting further out and moving inward, as far as kind of society in general, what is it that makes you think that, not that they haven't, but that society has kind of turned their back on you? What is that? Is it just not that you don't feel that you fit in, or how does that manifest itself for you?
Yeah, I'm not compatible with people in general. I just, the way I think, especially, I'm a writer and I'm an outsider from the beginning. So people enjoy my writing and that type of thing. I'm just cut off. There's no connection there. And there's almost a void within myself where I'm missing something, but I just can't seem to connect. And I'm not one of them.
Does it give you any kind of, peace or happiness or calmness that you're able to connect to other people through your writing?
Yes. The writing has always been a wonderful therapy for me. And it's a legitimate therapy too, like art therapy. But yeah, that's definitely a major method of exercising again the demon to the best of my ability. But yeah, it does bring me peace.
Do you feel that you're just kind of not cut out to say succeed by a traditional definition within society, or do you think it's more connections with people, or what is it that kind of drives your darker thoughts?
Yeah, it's all the above. I mean, the structuring of the present day society, I don't fit into it, and I recognize to a great degree that it's a scam, basically, and I see it as slavery. And I could never have somebody who perceived himself or herself as my quote unquote boss. I just can't abide that at all. I become very violent when somebody is delusional enough to think they're, say, above me or better than me, you know, so that drives me insane.
I think on the societal level, I think a lot of people could relate to what you're saying as far as not feeling like you fit in. Definitely, yes. A lot of issues with the structure of an office environment. Why do you think that your kind of solution or your impact on that is that you would like to resort to violence?
Yeah. Well, I guess part of it would be revenge, I suppose. On certain people, certain classes of people, I think a big part of that is a sense of wanting some vengeance against them, gritty and dark inside of me. But again, gain some control and put them in that place, I guess, certain people.
Let me ask you, as far as that goes, if you have ever, and it doesn't have to be anything violent or anything significant, but have ever been able to kind of seek revenge or kind of even the field with someone, did that make you feel better after being able to do that?
Yes. Thankfully, I've never crossed that precipice into a murder. But I've certainly come close with the stabbing of my best friend, or alleged stabbing, and that case is cleared up anyhow. He stabbed me first, as I say, a couple of years before that. But, I study jujitsu and chokes and strangulation, so I'm good at that. So it feels good to lock a choke onto somebody who's acting like a bully, I suppose. But again, it's never going into depth, so that's a plus for all involved.
As far as moving a little closer to home, as far as your childhood and your upbringing, how much impact do you think that has on your darker thoughts and feelings?
Well, my upbringing, it was a contentious upbringing. There's a lot of violence in my household and a lot of bloodshed. And for instance, getting beaten up over some missing popsicles that my cousin Eddie, and it wasn't me, I got a beating for that when I was maybe 8 or 9 years old, and I slept in that same bloodstained mattress for years from that beating. So that gives you kind of an idea of what that household was like. And it did affect me. Of course, it affects you. You can't help it. Not that I make excuses for anything I do, but you can't help it. It affects the wiring in the brain.
And did you have siblings that you lived with?
Yes, I had two sisters. I have two sisters, but I took the brunt of the brutality.
And certainly that is not a traditional childhood as far as most people have experienced. How much of kind of your inner demons or your inner darkness would you attribute to just you were born with it?
Yeah, and that's another very good question. Yeah, I think a big part of it is predisposition, definitely. Because my paternal grandmother used to refer to me as Cool Man Luke when I was like three years old, even because of my, lack of many emotions. So I really think I was born with it to a degree. And then, of course, your environment and other factors come into play. But yeah, predisposition is a very big part of it. Absolutely. Yeah, I have no doubt about that.
So in the book, you mentioned a number of diagnoses that you've been given, bipolar, antisocial, suffering from PTSD, OCD, and then also that you've experienced periods of like kind of psychotic episodes. What do you think you suffer from?
Demonic possession? I don't know. I mean, it's hard to pinpoint it. Doctors say bipolar and antisocial traits, OCD, of course. I had that since as long as I can remember, 6 years old or so, but I didn't know what it was back then. Yeah, and there are serious psychotic episodes, especially with the, you know, I have addiction problems too, you know, which I'm dealing with these days as far as that getting better from it, or of it. But yeah, alcohol brings out the worst in me too. That shuts things down where I have legitimate blackouts and I don't remember some things I do until the police are on my doorstep. And like I said, I don't make any excuses. It's just scary, and I'm fortunate I've never killed anybody during one of those blackouts.
How much clarity do you have into your psychotic episodes?
Well, I mean, logically, I understand them. But when you're in the midst of one of those episodes, like the detachment from anything rational, and the irrational seems perfectly like a sane idea, it seems perfectly normal to say want to go and strangle someone, for instance, you know, under those conditions. And it's very hard to get a handle on, you know, when you're in that position, especially you add alcohol into the mix, in my case, which is like liquid Satan for me personally.
Have you ever spoken to someone else who experiences psychotic episodes and kind of compared, or do you think you're similar or different in that regard?
My psychotic episodes are extremely terrifying for all involved. I mean, I scare myself. I don't know of anyone personally who has had the episodes at the level I experienced them. So, I mean, I can't really relate to anybody when it comes to those. It is like a possession, really. At least metaphorically speaking, it really is like a possession, overshadowing.
Yeah, it's probably a pretty good description of it. I was going to say, in the book, you mentioned your Uncle George, who he'd killed people during World War II.
Yeah.
And I guess my question is, so do you think like a war-type scenario where you would have done what he did, would that have calmed your inner demons?
I think it would have probably magnified them. It would have really magnified them and exacerbated everything a millionfold. Because it's like once they get a taste of that blood, like any shocks, you know, you just keep going after it. And there is no ending to it until either you're locked up or killed.
I was going to say, I think that kind of answers my question, but I was going to ask what you thought of someone like Arthur Shawcross, if he was put into that kind of scenario where it was basically legal to kill, do you think that would have just encouraged him further? It would not have satiated his kind of desire?
Well, he was in the Vietnam War and supposedly had killed some people over there, and so obviously it didn't help him. So no, it really does just make it worse and worse and worse. So like any addiction, really, just gets worse.
What do you think about someone who doesn't have that kind of inner demon being put into those kinds of situations? Do you think they can bounce back from that?
Well, no, they come back home and commit suicide, God bless them. I mean, you have to be a bit detached from humanity, I guess, or sociopathic in order to maintain relative sanity. I think that's my opinion.
Interesting comment to say that you need to be a little psychotic to be able to remain sane in that type of situation.
Yeah, or at least, like I say, sociopathic, so a detachment from humanity. But that's part of it. It's dehumanized. I mean, that's part of war anyway and part of the training.
So I guess my second question, my big question that I thought about throughout the book, which is is similar to my other question, but that is when you think about people who have these, you know, dark and murderous thoughts, what is it that keeps any of them from killing or killing more? In that, you know, an Arthur Shawcross or a BTK, you know, they killed a finite number of people, yet they had years and years and years where they could have been killing more and they didn't. What is it that stops that?
There's a lack of opportunity too, a lot of times. And there with serial killers, especially, there can be prolonged periods of cooling off, as they say. But a lot of times it's just lack of opportunity. That's what Jeff Dahmer said as well. So just, you know, you wait for the opportunities to present themselves. You know, you just fall into a normal routine in life. And so the affliction, it reemerges, you know, it comes to the surface again for whatever reason, whatever sets somebody off, you know, somebody making you angry or whatever the case may be, or again, being under the influence of alcohol or drugs. There are a number of factors, really. But yeah,
so opportunity. I think about, say, Arthur Shawcross and the idea that most people, if they had to be put in a room alone with him, when he was still physically and, you know, in a position physically able that he could harm somebody, most people would be absolutely terrified to be in that situation. Yet he's been alone with many people and he's never harmed them. So what is kind of your take on a scenario like that? Like, why are dangerous people able to not act on it at times?
Well, I mean, just because somebody, say, a multiple murderer, whatever, doesn't mean they're completely out of control. They're able to control themselves to some degree. And again, there are other factors. I mean, is the person with him making him angry? Is he doing something to trigger him? I mean, if you're not triggering the person, then there shouldn't be a problem. It's not like a completely out of control animal. See, so yeah, we do all have the ability to control ourselves.
Yeah, I that's what I guess I grapple with, is trying to understand where that line is for control with many of the chronic violent people.
Yeah, again, it's just triggers and opportunities.
Saying in the book, and you'd allude to it earlier in the interview, that the writing this book was a sort of literary exorcism. And I was just curious as to whether you felt that the writing this book did accomplish that.
Yeah, again, that was a big part of it, to exorcise the boogeyman. And yeah, it did to a tremendous degree through that. It did just that. My journey with these thoughts. And Arthur is basically a voice in the background, so to speak, you know, throughout. And he actually helped me through it too. As I say, an unwitting therapist in the darkest of senses. But I mean,
I guess some positive that came out of Arthur Shawcross.
Exactly. Yes, for sure. You know, so again, I never took that path. I never went all the way with that, but I've certainly been very close and have firsthand understanding of what it's like to suffer with these thoughts. I think Arthur was more evil, and admittedly so, that he was evil. But, you know, like a Dahmer or myself, I do have a conscience, and I'm not evil. There's just, you know, like I say, this very, very severe separation anxiety and feeling of not being in control. And so, you know, that's the only way, a very primitive way, for sure, but to gain control over people, just to maintain these friendships again. But so, I mean, I'm a passionate person. I have a soul. But Shawcross was, again, he was actually evil, you know, for sure.
Well, to wrap up, I just want to ask you, do you have any current writing projects, or what are you planning on writing in the future?
There's a possibility I might do a follow-up with Arthur's daughter. So that's a possibility. I might be doing something along those lines. I have a couple of other books on the back burner, too, that are like a horror satire, you know, a blend of horror and satire about, you know, satirical horror.
Would you consider it dark humor?
Yeah, absolutely.
I would imagine.
Yes.
Your book, The Shawcross Letters, I read it in one day. I was absolutely drawn in, and I couldn't put it down. I mean, it was such a journey listening kind of to your life story, but just through the letters, and it was just an incredibly well-written and just really engrossing book.
Thank you so much. That means everything to me. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, you really, I mean, as best you can and as much as you enjoy it, I would definitely encourage you to keep writing, because you have a talent, and it is very, very interesting. And I don't know if I'll say entertaining, but it certainly kept me captivated, you know, reading what you wrote.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that, John.
It's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
I'm making just keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros, two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude, stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
John and I have become really good friends, and his show, Twisted Podcast, is amazing. You can follow John Taylor on Twitter. His handle is TRTA24, which is the acronym for the inmates are running the asylum, followed by the number 24. All right, guys, so you just heard the Shawcross letters, and I wanted to bring in someone who is kind of a big deal. Her name is Allison Sweeney, and you might know her from Days of Our Lives, The Biggest Loser, and she has a new project, and I want to talk to her about it, because she, too, is pretending to be someone else. So, yeah. Allie, welcome to Pretend Radio.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, so let's talk about the Shawcross letters.
Yeah, that was really fascinating.
That was creepier than an actual serial killer, like, piece.
Okay, so I had the exact same reaction because the anger, like the triggers he talked about and the rage. Yeah. And like, I just felt that it just seemed so real. And yet I just felt like, I don't know how you control that. And then some serial killers like Shawcross almost also seemed a little methodical. So like, how does the rage or the anger fit into that profile?
Well, and you know, I'm not like a serial killer aficionado or anything like that, you know?
Right.
But I mean, I've read, you know, I've actually read Mindhunter, you know, that FBI book that was later turned into like a Netflix series. And, you know, like right now there's that Ted Bundy thing on Netflix, and we're all like so fascinated with the serial killers. And it's kind of cool that we get to hear Ted Bundy and all that. But like talking to this guy was like, it was like talking to like a serial killer, like in that time period, you know, like.
Right. While it was all. Yeah.
As they're thinking about it, not like after.
And the mummies, like when he said he liked the control or the friend that never leaves you because you, I just thought that was, it was really honest. I mean, it just was alarming, but honest.
Part of it was kind of sad, wasn't it? Like the fact that he grew such a, like a tight friendship with this serial killer and like now he's gone.
Right. And the whole letters thing too is fascinating. I do want to get this book because I thought, just the idea of that kind of old-fashioned relationship, like a pen pal, you know, now today feels so distant somehow, but like to open up your heart and then, or your mind or your emotions, I guess, to this stranger who just happens to have the same feelings you do. I don't know. I think it's fascinating. And then to have him reply. And like he said, I really want to read the letters because he was saying how it goes from one paragraph to the next, you know, in intensity to like, oh, the weather's nice this week. You know, I mean, I thought that was kind of a fascinating thing too, right? Like maybe he doesn't like dinner that night, you know, and you're going to hear that as well. And just that in some ways he's a human too. Ugh.
Yeah. And I think what's unsettling is how human he is, right?
Like, yes.
Like it seems like he could be my neighbor, or your neighbor, right? Like,
yeah. They are human.
And that self-control, because I know this sounds like, I don't want to make light of it, that desire for cannibalism.
Right.
Where does that come from? Because if you've never been a cannibal, what makes you crave that?
Right.
I love Italian food. I like Mexican food, but that's because I've had some really good Mexican food. You know what I mean?
Right, right. Sometimes I want, it's like Thin Mint time and Girl Scout cookies. Right. And I'm like, I'm like excited about it, right? Like, but you're right.
But obviously it's not that, right? Like
it can't be that. It has to be part of that psychological thing he was talking about.
Like a control. Like it, like collecting shrunken heads, you know? Why?
And how does that manifest itself? Like how do you then realize? I mean, at what point do you sort of have that real moment where you're like, oh, I know what I want to do?
Yeah.
you know, and then you're realizing like, that's not normal. You know, I mean, and this guy has lived with it and contained it, right? So he has had this awareness that I am not like everybody else, and nobody else sort of, you know, has feelings like this or yearnings like this. And I better, and yet he's sort of sympathetic enough, he said, kind of, that he's like, I haven't gone through with it. It felt like a thin shearing between doing it and not doing it. It did not feel like, oh, there's this wall of things I won't do.
Yeah. And to me, I mean, part of me is kind of glad that he's so open about it, because in a way, that's like his insurance policy, right? With the world, that he's like, I have two choices. I could keep these demons in my head and you'll never know about it, and I could act on it, or I don't, but that's up to me. But by telling the world, like, it's almost like, hey, world, I have this sixth desire. Now you know about it. You know what I mean? Like, you've been warned.
Well, that's so creepy. But I do think that there is something to be said for that. And I wish, and maybe in the book he talks about more, that what is the connection to his troubled childhood? And perhaps there is real value to learning how he came to have the feelings he has. And maybe, you know, his willingness to talk about it probably helped him, right? Instead of keeping all those feelings bundled up inside. Maybe that was part of his process to, you know, deal with it, was to be more upfront than we're comfortable with. But maybe it really does serve a good of helping people maybe understand it better. I'm interested in listening to the Twisted podcast, because I think like that he was a really good interviewer. I really liked his style too.
All right, Allie. So thank you so much for coming on my show, by the way. But we have mutual like friends, right? This is, tell people how we know about each other. Cause you know, like, how did this happen?
Well, I feel like the fan here, like just so you know, I have been listening to podcasts and getting into sort of this, I don't know, the podcast genre, I guess, for about 2 years. I can't even tell you the last time I listened to a song on my phone. A few of the podcasts that I listened to recommended your podcast. I had to check it out because the women at Moms and Murder talk about you, and Esther from Once Upon a Crime. Like, you have lots of fans. You've got game.
I didn't realize I had game. Yeah. But yeah, Melissa and Mandy had you on their show, and you were so nice to like record a little message for my mom, who is like a huge fan of yours. And I grew up watching you, by the way. And we're like about the same age too. So it's like you and Alyssa Milano, you guys are like, you know,
we grew up together.
We grew up together, right? So it was so cool that, you know, like Melissa and Mandy had you on your show. And then, you know, we happened to meet that way on Twitter. One day I asked you, hey, we need to get you on the show somehow, right?
Yeah.
And you said, yeah.
Well, now's the moment.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
So let's talk about you and your new project, because you're kind of stepping into the podcast world in a way, right?
Exactly. So yeah, it just all came from listening to so many great podcasts and realizing from a storyteller's point of view that this is a job, it's a role that would be a perfect opportunity to create a series around. And in fact, you know, I sort of look around like I'm shocked it hasn't happened yet. I love working with Hallmark. So I pitched them the idea of a podcaster who is out there solving these cold cases. I have 1,000 ideas in my head every day for a new episode of my mystery series. It's called The Chronicle Mysteries. My character is an independent podcaster, but she ends up getting kind of connected to a local newspaper. And so she's sort of supporting the paper with her podcast, and she gets all the back issues and the files, you know, the backdated issues from the newspaper. And there's a journalist. Of course, you know, we have a little bit of a love story there, you know, and some fun.
You have to.
Yeah, of course. You know, it was a great opportunity to bring in what a big difference these podcasts can make in someone's life. Like, you know, and then how hard that is, right? How hard the hope is of like, oh, and I'm sure you must feel this, people turning to you, telling you their story, and then expect, you know, I'm sure they don't expect everything, but they're hoping it will make this big difference. It'll change something. Yeah. And that sits on your shoulders too.
And so tell me, how many miniseries are there?
So I made 3 movies last year, and each movie has like a ending, right? So each movie is close-ended for the case that we're working on, but the characters continue, and you'll get to see more of them developing, you know, their interpersonal relationships.
Well, I want to thank you so much for like supporting the indie podcast scene, because, you know, a lot of people listen to This American Life, Serial, Criminal. I mean, we get hooked by the big ones, right? But I've just noticed by your interactions on Twitter and stuff like that, you're really a big supporter of the indie scene. And that's really awesome.
You know, I love a good story. And I think what I love about what you're doing and what all the indie podcasts out there are doing is just bringing back this storytelling that is really at the heart of like who we are as people.
To hear more of my conversation with John Taylor and Allison Sweeney, go to pretendradio.org and click the donate button. John Fay's book, The Shawcross Letters, is available through Amazon and wildbluepress.com. Again, thank you to John Taylor from the Twisted Podcast for sharing your episode. And thank you to Allison Sweeney for coming on the show. And check out her new movie franchise on Hallmark called The Chronicle Mysteries. I'll talk to you guys real soon.
Creative Back.